deadly gunfire in Indianapolis. I'm Pam Puso, Fox News. Two people are dead and police say two others were sent to the hospital following an overnight shooting near a Boston Market restaurant. At this time, it's unclear if police have any suspects. A man was shot and wounded by police at a crowded park in Denver as they responded to reports that someone was firing a gun out of a car.
It does appear that he did fire the weapon. We don't know if he fired at officers, but that will be part of the investigation.
Denver Police Division Chief Ron Thomas, no one at the park was hurt yesterday. The suspect's condition is unknown. A ruling by a federal judge overturning California's ban on assault weapons is being blasted by Governor Gavin Newsom, who calls it a direct threat to public safety. The judge ruled the three-decade-old ban violates the constitutional right to bear arms. Judge Roger Benitez of San Diego issued a permanent injunction against enforcement of the law, but stayed it for 30 days to give the state time to appeal. The latest infrastructure offer made by Republicans has fallen short of President Biden's objectives, but the White House says the president will speak again Monday with Senator Shelley Moore Capito. He's been keeping a relatively low profile, but former President Donald Trump is expected to headline North Carolina's GOP convention tonight. The event comes one day after a decision by Facebook to suspend his account for at least 2 years.
The company plans to review the ban in January of 2023, making Trump eligible for reinstatement before the next presidential election. In a statement, Trump calls the ban, quote, an insult to the Americans who voted for him.
Fox's Bill Malusian, the former president, was banned from the platform after the Capitol riot. America's listening to Fox News. Another night of angry protest in Minneapolis following Thursday's deadly police-involved shooting.
The U.S. Marshals Service says their task force confronted a man in a vehicle who was wanted on a state warrant for being a felon in possession of a firearm. When he refused to comply with their demands and produced a handgun, they say they opened fire. Relatives have identified him as Winston Smith. Waylon Hughes says he's one of his closest friends, and he dismissed the State Bureau of Criminal Apprehension's finding that Smith opened fire from inside his car.
He doesn't carry a gun, so you can't even paint that picture. I'm here to clear all of that up.
He says Smith was reaching for his phone to document police interaction. The Bureau says the U.S. Marshals Service does not allow body cameras to be worn by members of this task force. Jessica Rosenthal, Fox News.
In Chicago, a renewed effort to build trust between police and the neighborhoods they serve.
Community engagement, which means all officers in the Chicago Police Department, all bureaus, all units, will engage the community.
While outlining a new community policing strategy, Police Superintendent David Brown said policing is a people business. Brown believes that building trust will drive down crime. It's been nearly a week since a mass shooting in South Florida, and police are still searching for three suspects. The shooting outside a banquet hall in Hialeah left three people dead. Police say the uptick in shootings has led to a countywide crime initiative.
We're leveraging our intelligence, and most importantly, we're leveraging the heart of the people of Miami-Dade.
Miami Police Chief Art Acevedo. It won't be long before Florida's cruise terminals start getting busy again. Royal Caribbean says eight of its ships will resume U.S. voyages in July. The first one will be aboard the Freedom of the Seas. It's scheduled to leave Miami on July 2nd. I'm Pam Puso, Fox News.
On the Virginia side of the Beltway right now, there isn't any construction, and I don't have any reports of any accidents, so you'll be traveling at the posted speed limit on the inner loop and on the outer loop. On 66 in Fairfax County, that is clear on the eastbound side and on the westbound side. And on 95 in Virginia, between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, on the southbound side, traffic is slow between Opitz Boulevard and the Truckway Station. No delays on the northbound side of 95 in Virginia. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Sunglasses and sunscreen, a must today. Temperatures into the low 90s with lots of sunshine, a high UV index as well. Should be fairly comfortable, though, because humidity remains in check. Overnight temperatures back in the 60s, mainly clear, calm. Temperatures tomorrow in the low 90s, but we had a touch more humidity. Still dry as far as storm chances, maybe an isolated one Monday. Temperatures then still in the low 90s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Brian Vandergraff in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
Now, the Saturday morning update. 105.9
FM, WMAL. Good morning. It is the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jeff Wolf is behind the console. Jane Houghton, our producer this morning. And we've got a lot to cover, from Capitol Hill to ransomware to COVID-19. And, of course, we have our experts to join us this morning. We're going to be talking with John Gizzi about the very latest on the infrastructure negotiations. The West Virginia Senator Shelley Moore Capito had a private meeting with President Biden this week. Depending on which side of the aisle you want to listen to, the spin is out. And a very interesting topic indeed as we move forward in this whole debate over infrastructure and the spending. President Trump will be speaking tonight at the North Carolina Republican Convention. This is his second major speech since leaving office. He has also announced that he will do a Florida rally. But the eyes will be on North Carolina tonight to see what the former president has to say. Facebook has banned the former president and suspended him for another 2 years. Well, doesn't that get us right through the 2022 elections, giving Democrats cover from the former president's voice on Facebook leading in to the midterm elections? Wonder if that's a coincidence or not. Jim Trusty will join us this morning. Of course, he is our legal expert, and we're going to be talking with Jim about the prosecution of the two teenage girls in the carjacking case here in the district. Of course, that resulted in the death of Uber driver Mohammed Anwar. The juveniles were in court this week, and Jim will give us the very latest. And you may have heard the debate in South Dakota. The governor, Kristi Noem, had filed for a permit to hold a fireworks show at Mount Rushmore, very similar to the one that President Trump held. And you may remember if you watched it or you at least saw some of the clips from it, it was quite striking to have that fireworks celebration. But it went to court because the National Park Service said, nope, got a lot of reasons not to do it. Jim will have the outcome and the rationale for the court decision. It's coming up within the hour this morning. We're going to check in with Cheryl Atkinson, and she has been delving into the origins of COVID-19, and she was on that case earlier than the mainstream media that's now looking at it after categorically denying it throughout the Trump administration. Now everybody's going, oh, maybe you got something there. Maybe it, well, it did come out of the lab. Maybe it didn't come from a bat. We're going to talk with Cheryl Atkinson about that. We'll also talk with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, because Tony's got the angle of the gain of function terminology, which you're hearing about in terms of the work being done at the Wuhan lab, where the coronavirus, some say, may have originated. And we'll find out a little more about what the research means. Tony will go into detail with us this morning on that, so that will be a very interesting conversation indeed. We'll also be talking with Tony about the ransomware demands out there. KT McFarland will join us, and we'll talk with her about ransomware and the foreign policy crises that are facing the Biden administration and the country. And ransomware seems to be front and center now. You know, we didn't pay too much attention to it when companies were being hit. It didn't have a national impact, and we just kind of looked the other way. Somebody paid the ticket and moved on. Well, it's gotten a little more important because it has begun to impact us. We saw what happened with that Colonial Pipeline hack. Well, the world's largest meat processing company, you heard about this one, of course, JBS Meats, has finally resumed most production after the cyber attack last weekend. But experts are saying, according to CBS News reporting, experts say the vulnerabilities exposed by the attack and others are far from resolved. Now, in a statement late Wednesday, the FBI attributed the attack to Revel. That's a Russian-speaking gang that has made some of the largest ransomware demands on record in recent months. The FBI said it will work to bring the group to justice, and it urged anyone who is the victim of a cyber attack to contact the FBI immediately. Well, here's how the White House is looking at it. This is Jen Psaki, and she was asked a question by CNN's Caitlin Collins.
On these ransomware attacks, does the president view those as a national security threat?
I certainly think the president views those as a rising national security concern and an area where we need to continue to keep our focus, keep our assets, focus on energy and brain power on what we can do to address it. Certainly this is a priority to him and an area where we will be spending a significant amount of time in the coming months.
A priority, but at the same time, here's additional comment from the White House Press Secretary, Jen Psaki, and it kind of sounds like she's putting the responsibility on the corporations.
Business leaders have a responsibility to strengthen their cyber defenses to protect the American public and our economy.
So I was just mentioning the FBI actually attributing the most recent attack to this Russian-speaking gang named Revel. Well, Vladimir Putin was speaking yesterday. Here's what he has to say about the ransomware attacks in the U.S., and this is through a translator.
It's just ridiculous to blame Russia for this. I think that the relevant U.S. services should find out who the scammers are, not Russia for sure. For us to extort money from some company, we are not dealing with some chicken meat or beef. It's just hilarious.
So Putin thinks it's hilarious. It's going to be a fascinating summit when Joe Biden sits down with Vladimir Putin, I tell you that. Very interesting comments from the new sergeant-at-arms in the U.S. Senate. She is Karen Gibson, and here's how she prioritizes the ransomware attacks. And keep in mind as you listen to this, all of the attention that the Democrats have focused on January 6th riots at the Capitol, and they want to do a 9/11 style commission, and the fence stayed up forever, and the Democrats want to just keep that story going as long as they possibly can. But listen to the priorities from the U.S. Senate Sergeant at Arms.
I worry a lot more about cybersecurity than I do about another mob attacking the Capitol. Certainly our networks have attempted intrusions every single day. And so cybersecurity for me is a much greater concern than the prospect of thousands of people storming the West Terrace.
Very interesting that she puts cybersecurity ahead of another January 6th. And here's more from Karen Gibson. She was speaking on CNN with CNN's Pamela Brown.
Christopher Wray, the FBI director, compared the current cyber threat with ransomware to the terrorism threat around 9/11. Do you view it that way, too?
I think whether it's ransomware or other cybersecurity threats, yes. I actually, again, I see cybersecurity as my greater concern.
Very interesting. And we have time now to check the traffic and weather here in the WMAL Traffic Center, and we'll also get a look at the weather for the weekend, and hopefully we'll be drying out a little bit.
In D.C. on 295, 395, and 695, I'm checking out the traffic cameras. I don't see any accidents, and I have no reports of any construction being set up yet. Now into Maryland on the Beltway. From Prince George's County through Montgomery County, bridge to bridge, on the inner loop and on the outer loop, you won't be hitting the brakes. Traveling between the two beltways, on the BW Parkway and on 95, northbound lanes are clear and the southbound lanes are clear. And on Route 50 in Prince George's County, no delays between the beltway and the Bay Bridge. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Sunglasses and sunscreen, a must today. Temperatures into the low 90s with lots of sunshine, a high UV index as well. Should be fairly comfortable, though, because humidity remains in check. Overnight temperatures back in the 60s, mainly clear, calm. Temperatures tomorrow in the low 90s, but we had a touch more humidity. Still dry as far as storm chances, maybe an isolated one. Monday, temperatures then still in the low 90s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Brian Vandergraff in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
64 degrees in the nation's capital, 619 on the Saturday morning update.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It is the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. Glad to have you with us. And you may have heard about the jobs report yesterday. The experts had expected 650,000 new jobs to be announced. Well, they came in at 559,000, so they missed that one by about 100,000. 6,000 jobs. Most are calling it a lackluster jobs report. The unemployment rate was down to 5.8%, but many attribute that to people dropping out of the workforce and dropping out of the search for jobs. There's been a lot of debate about whether there is too much in terms of benefits being provided, and many workers are just staying home because they're doing pretty well on the different assistance programs, and it is not an incentive to get people back to work. So, of course, that's all part of the big infrastructure debate and the funding for COVID relief debate that is continuing on Capitol Hill. A lot of attention, I'm sure you have seen, to West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin and Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema, both Democrats, both very moderate Democrats, both Democrats in red states, West Virginia much more so than Arizona has become in terms of its ability to be relied upon as a red state. We saw what happened with President Trump's voting in Arizona, but it is a very, very strong Republican state. So Kyrsten Sinema has to kind of walk that fine line about being a moderate. So a lot of people are putting a lot of pressure on Sinema and on Joe Manchin from the left. The progressives are all over him to, number one, eliminate the filibuster, number two, to come through on some of these critical votes on funding and infrastructure and all the money the Democrats want to spend. So Kyrsten Sinema was asked about it, and the Senate has talked about different rules changes and, in particular, eliminating the filibuster. And I thought Kyrsten Sinema had a very interesting take on it.
I would think that most would agree that the Senate's not a particularly well-oiled machine, right? The way to fix that is to change your behavior, not to eliminate the rules or change the rules.
That's great. I mean, what a great attitude. Don't change the rules, change the behavior. So where is the problem? Well, here is the problem. Chuck Schumer.
The American people gave us a Democratic Senate to produce big and bold change on the major issues confronting us, and that is what we are doing.
No, Chuck, a very slim number of people in Georgia gave you the U.S. Senate, not the American people. It is so razor thin in terms of the voting, the split down the middle between red and blue across this country. And Schumer thinks he's got some kind of huge mongoose mandate to swing so far to the left and change the rules of the Senate and everything else, when that big majority he thinks he has is like a handful of people in Georgia in a runoff election. So try and keep it in perspective, Chuck. You might want to talk to Kyrsten Sinema one day and let her get some sense into your head. We've heard so much about this research being done at the Wuhan lab. What does all that mean? A lot of attention this week on emails released from Dr. Tony Fauci. During the week, we've seen some of these emails come out, a lot of confusion. And Dr. Fauci has been under a lot of pressure for what they call flip-flopping, conflicting statements. You know, we're looking at one angle for several weeks, and then we do a reversal of course. You know, what about masks? Should we wear masks? Do they provide the protection that we hope masks provide or not? And there's a lot of back and forth. I thought there was one clip from Dr. Fauci that was kind of interesting in this whole question of the research being done and the origins of the virus. And this might even provide a little confusion as you listen to it.
We all felt, and still do actually, Willie, that it is more likely to be a natural jumping of species from an animal reservoir to a human. But the fact that it could have been something else clearly was there. It was low on the list of what we thought the likelihood was.
Here's another thing he had to say, and we'll talk about this in a second.
The idea, I think, is quite far-fetched that the Chinese deliberately engineered something so that they could kill themselves as well as other people. I think that's a bit far out, John.
Well, it might be a bit far out. Maybe they didn't intend to kill their own people, but maybe they were working on some kind of research in terms of bioweapons that they could ultimately in the future turn loose on another country. Maybe that was what was going on, and it accidentally escaped from the lab, which is why it ended up killing many Chinese, but it could have been something they're working on.
I don't know. I'm not the expert.
But there are a lot of theories out there. A lot of people are calling them conspiracy theories. I'm sure you're formulating your own opinions as you hear what he has to say, as you look at the email exchanges, and as you hear the pundits on the left, and as you hear the pundits on the right. So, fascinating conversation to be continued. 626, it's the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
In other news at this hour, a federal judge has overturned California's three-decade-old ban on assault weapons. He ruled that it violates the constitutional rights to bear arms. U.S. District Judge Roger Benitez of San Diego ruling yesterday that the state's definition of illegal military-style rifles unlawfully deprives law-abiding Californians of weapons commonly allowed in most other states. Experts are investigating after the computer systems of two Central Florida hospitals showed signs of unusual activity. News outlets report that the Villages Regional Hospital and the University of Florida Health Leesburg Hospital shut down multiple systems to protect patient information. A spokesman said the healthcare system has learned the activity was related to a cybersecurity event. UN experts say Taliban insurgents show no sign of reducing the level of violence in Afghanistan to facilitate peace negotiations with the government. The experts said in a report to the UN Security Council circulated Friday that the Taliban appears to be trying to strengthen its military position as leverage with the unprecedented violence of 2020 carrying into 2021. And in New York, a second woman has come forward with sexual misconduct accusations against a mayoral candidate. He's also the city controller. It's Scott Stringer. Teresa Logan tells the New York Times that Stringer groped her and made unwanted advances when she worked as a waitress in 1992 at a bar that he ran. Logan says she decided to come forward after hearing the account of Jean Kim, who says Stringer groped her without consent in 2001. The 61-year-old Democratic candidate has denied Kim's accusations. In response to Logan's claims, he says he does not remember, but is sorry if he ever did anything to make her uncomfortable. 6:32, time for a check of the traffic and weather in LBD's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In D.C., on 295, 395, and 695, plus the tunnels and bridges, no construction and no accidents to slow you down this morning. Into Virginia, on the Beltway, inner loop and outer loop are at speed. Here again, no construction or accidents in the way. On 66 in Fairfax County, that is clear eastbound and westbound. And on 95 in Virginia, between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, you're not going to be tapping the brakes on the northbound side or on the southbound side. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Sunglasses and sunscreen, a must today. Temperatures into the low 90s with lots of sunshine, a high UV index as well. Should be fairly comfortable, though, because humidity remains in check. Overnight temperatures back in the 60s, mainly clear, calm. Temperatures tomorrow in the low 90s, but we'll add a touch more humidity. Still dry as far as storm chances, maybe an isolated one Monday. Temperatures then still in the low 90s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Brian Vandergraff in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
64 degrees, 6:33 in the nation's capital on WMAL. The Saturday Morning Update continues. Thank you for being with us this morning. Jennifer Harper joins us. She writes Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Always a pleasure to have you join us, Jennifer.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
Stories in the news this week about the government report on UFOs. Now the big question is, how much are they telling us, and how do Americans feel about digging into it? We have commissions, we have congressional hearings, which are all very public. How does the public feel about making more information about UFOs public?
Well, you know, it's a very interesting situation right now because the report that you mentioned, some of that has been not necessarily leaked out, but it's been talked about a lot. And so far, it looks like they're using the old neither confirming or denying the existence of UFOs, kind of the way they do when other nuclear weapons on this base. They neither confirm or deny. They're using the same method right now. But let's go on to the more interesting part of all this. And all the pollsters are very eager to talk about how people feel about UFOs or UAPs, if that's what you want to call them. I like UFO better. That sounds more romantic. I don't know why, but it does. But anyway, let's go on to our poll. This is an Economist YouGov poll conducted May 29 through June 1. So this is pretty recent. And believe it or not, 21% of U.S. adults definitely say that aliens exist. 39% say they probably exist. And I found it interesting, too, when I looked at the political demographics, that Republicans, believe it or not, have stronger feelings than their peers in the other parties. 21% of Republicans believe that there are aliens out there compared to 20% of independents and 18% of Democrats. But let's talk about that report, though. It's getting a lot of support out there in the public. And 33% of U.S. adults strongly approve of U.S. government agencies investigating UFOs. And most of the demographics here right across the board between Republicans, independents, and Democrats are almost all the same. 33% somewhat approve of the agencies investigating UFOs. And again, very similar. It's about a third of each of the demographics here all agree with all this. And only 8% overall somewhat disapprove, and 4% strongly disapprove. And the rest, 22%, are not quite sure. But what it tells me about all this is that people are paying attention to this, whether or not they believe or they don't believe. I think it's a kind of a good diversion right now from all of the pandemic and everything else that's worrying people. And, you know, why not look at the footage shot by our friends up there in the air in the U.S. Navy? So that's what's going on UFOs this morning.
Well, you know, they're always kind of buzzing around and you can't tell what they are. I don't know why one of them just doesn't come and park right downtown in the middle of D.C., like in the movie The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Yeah, and you know, that was a lot of that was shot in D.C. I think some of that was shot in the Department of Agriculture. So who knows? Maybe it will happen.
There will be an identified flying object coming up. That is President Biden as he goes overseas. Let's hope the winds stay calm. Tell us about the trip.
Well, it's pretty interesting because he's going royal on this trip. It's been announced this week that the Queen will meet the President of the United States of America and First Lady Jill Biden at Windsor Castle on Sunday, 13th June 2021. That is an official tweet from the royal family that came out on Thursday. So I felt like going, ta-da! But anyway, all that means is that Queen Elizabeth is going to welcome the Bidens at Windsor Castle, and she's currently celebrating her remarkable reign, which began in 1952. And believe it or not, the Queen has met with 13 out of the last 14 sitting U.S. presidents. Of course, I wanted to know what the heck happened, who's the other president, and I looked at the White House Historical Association's website, and they told me. They say Queen Elizabeth II never met President Lyndon Johnson during his presidency and was unable to attend John F. Kennedy's funeral because she was pregnant with Prince Edward. So that's why she didn't meet with one of our presidents. And anyway, the other part of this very busy itinerary that President Biden is going to have during his first presidential trip overseas for the G7 summit, he's going to be punctuated by a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. So should be very interesting for the press to cover this.
Well, we had a couple of successful Bushes in politics, very successful, and we had one that was moderately successful. What's the news on the next Bush in the big time?
Well, let's talk about George P. Bush. Now, a lot of people know who he is, but you may not know that he is the son of Jeb Bush, former Florida governor and presidential hopeful. He's the nephew of former President George W. Bush, and George H.W. Bush is his grandfather. And the reason I paid attention to him is because I found out that George P. Bush is now being dubbed 47. Let's think about that. Interesting, eh?
Wouldn't that be funny?
But anyway, he is one of the very few of the Bushes who has positive feelings and has and supported former President Donald Trump. And Politico, MSNBC, lots of news organizations have always caught note of this over the years, because the 45th president, he still has a lot of appeal down there in the Lone Star State. But let's get back to George P. Bush for a moment. He's very methodical about being a politician, because he ran for Texas Land Commissioner a couple years ago, and he won. He's been down there doing his job, creating good feelings out there, and it's kind of old-school politics. He's starting at the bottom and working his way up. And he has now declared that he is running for Attorney General of Texas. So that's one step up again. And remember, he was called 47, and I'll tell you who called him that. That was Mark McKinnon. He's a very prominent GOP advisor. He was an advisor for George W. Bush and also the late Senator John McCain and some other political heavyweights out there. But let's talk about Mr. Bush, the younger Mr. Bush. He's an attorney. He's a former U.S. Navy Reserve intelligence officer. He's a married father of two. He speaks fluent Spanish. That's because his mother is Columba Bush. She was born in Mexico. And he is the co-founder of Hispanic Republicans of Texas as a political action committee. And here's what he has to say. I'm a conservative advocate for the state of Texas, but without the baggage. That is what Mr. Bush, the younger, tells Fox News in a very wide-ranging interview this week. He said, I bring a legal background to the table, and I'm excited to go down to the border to talk about the lax Biden border policies that's resulted in the largest surge of illegal immigration in modern American history. Again, this is coming from George P. Bush. He says, I've been a servant to this country. I served in the military for 10 years. I've served the state of Texas as its land commissioner, managing its assets, protecting the federal overreach that we've seen in the oil and gas industry. I'm prepared and I'm ready to take this fight to D.C. Again, this is George P. Bush talking this week. If you're curious about him, it's worth a look. Go see georgepbush.com.
A lot of questions being asked about the future of the relationship between former President Trump and the grand old party. Show me the money. Where does the money trail lead us, Jennifer?
Well, I found this to be very interesting, because there has been a lot of noise in the press about a big division between establishment Republicans and President Trump and the Trumpsters and yadda-da-da-da. It goes on and on and on and on. And I keep getting messages from the Republican National Committee about their fundraising for former President Donald Trump. And he is former President Donald Trump. And here's, I'm just going to read you one of their pitches. It says, Trump rallies are back. Despite big tech's efforts to silence President Trump, he's announced his plans to come to Florida to speak to great American patriots at an epic rally. With your support, Republicans will post a massive fundraising haul on the day of President Trump's Florida rally, which will show that he still has the support of true patriots. Big tech can't silence that. We are working day and night to defend the Trump legacy and stand up to liberal censorship. If we aren't fully funded, the liberal media will continue to censor President Trump, including his upcoming rallies. Now, that came from Donald Trump, right? No, that came from the Republican National Committee this week. So wow. I was like, wow, are you guys friends now, or is there some harmony happening? And, you know, we may know sooner or later. As soon as the Florida rally comes and goes, perhaps we will know. But Mr. Trump's public event, next big one, is today. He's going to be in North Carolina doing it at the North Carolina Republican Party's convention. And so we shall see. It's interesting, though, I thought.
You know, what's interesting is, with the exception of Fox News Channel and Cheryl Atkinson, very little television news coverage of what actually is going on at the southern border. You actually have a story about a day with the Customs and Border Patrol.
I do, and I do make a point of following them as much as I can, because really it's just their work is quite amazing. What I'm going to read to you is a report from one day, okay? These reports were issued on Tuesday of this week, and I'm just going to tell you what they did, okay? This is according to official reports that were filed on Tuesday alone, Rick. Officers disrupted six human smuggling attempts near the Rio Grande River in Havana, Texas. They investigated five human smuggling stash houses in the Rio Grande Valley and arrested 160 undocumented individuals hidden inside two tractor trailers near Laredo, Texas. Wait, there's more. Agents also thwarted three smuggling attempts of methamphetamine and cocaine worth $3.5 million, hidden in shipments of fresh cabbage and mangoes aboard tractor trailer trucks at the FAR International Bridge Cargo Facility in FAR, Texas. Agents also arrested a U.S. citizen attempting to smuggle 63.8 pounds of methamphetamine worth about $175,000 through an immigration checkpoint near Sultan City, California. They also rescued a lost undocumented migrant in the Jacumba Wilderness region near Ocotillo, California, and transported this person to the hospital and apprehended a convicted felon who illegally entered the U.S. near Yuma, Arizona. That's one report on one day, okay? And if you're curious, like I always am, go to cbp.gov, look under the newsroom heading, and you can get some insight about our heroes down there on the southern border.
Jennifer Harper, Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times, and you can follow her on Twitter at Harper Bulletin. Thank you very much. 6:46, time for a check of the traffic and weather with Al BD, and then we're back with Jim Trusty.
On the Maryland side of the Beltway right now, from Prince George's County through Montgomery County, on the inner loop and on the outer loop, I'm looking in the traffic cameras, there is no construction and I have no reports of any accidents, so you will be at the posted speed limit. Traveling between the two beltways, on the VW Parkway and on 95, clear northbound and southbound. In Prince George's County on Route 50, between the beltway and Annapolis, nothing to report eastbound or westbound. And if you're going over the Bay Bridge, you have two lanes headed east and three lanes coming west with no delays on either shoreline. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Sunglasses and sunscreen, a must today. Temperatures into the low 90s with lots of sunshine, a high UV index as well. Should be fairly comfortable, though, because humidity remains in check. Overnight temperatures back in the 60s, mainly clear, calm. Temperatures tomorrow in the low 90s, but we had a touch more humidity. Still dry as far as storm chances, maybe an isolated one. Monday, temperatures then still in the low 90s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Brian Vandergraff in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
64 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:47 on the Saturday morning update on WMAL.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
Saturday morning update continues. Jim Trusty joins us. He is the former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the U.S. Department of Justice, now in Washington, a partner at IFRA Law. Jim, good to have you with us.
Good morning, Rick.
Jim, a story that was so tragic and troubling here for all of us in the metro area, and actually it was a national story, and that the death of Mohammed Anwar, the Uber Eats driver, the botched carjacking in D.C. outside of Nats Park, a 15-year-old suspect and a 13-year-old suspect. They went to court. Jim, what happened?
Well, they're mostly through the process. There were decisions that were made by the D.C. prosecutors early on to treat them as juveniles, and we'll circle back to that, but that's the fundamental, you know, biggest point of the litigation. Once they were treated as juveniles, they each entered guilty pleas to second-degree murder, and the first of the two young women was sentenced the other day to the maximum penalty in juvenile court, which is to be under the court's jurisdiction until the age of 21. So, you know, again, there are very fundamental differences between juvenile prosecution and adult prosecution, and we're seeing them play out in this case.
So, in essence, that's a six-year sentence. What happens when she's 21? Is she out?
Yeah, when she's 21, it's over. And, you know, when we created a juvenile system within the criminal justice system, and it's state by state and federal, there's differences between all of them. And you know, the idea was that juveniles can be rehabilitated, that we can still save some of these juveniles, and we should create a system that reflects that, that gives them some privacy, gives them rehabilitation, and keeps them from, you know, as I used to say as a prosecutor, going to crime school. You know, sometimes they go into prison for punitive purposes, and they come out considerably worse for that. The problem is that, you know, these are very difficult times. You have juvenile offenders who are engaged in really shocking behavior that really, you know, makes you wonder, is there anything that's going to rehabilitate them within the juvenile system? The high-end options within the juvenile system, meaning high levels of restraint or something akin to a juvenile prison, those have shrunk over time, partly because of litigation, partly because of resource problems. And so it is a softer existence in the juvenile system than it used to be. And by the way, you know, once you're 21, you're done. I mean, there's no kind of ongoing supervised release or probation that kicks in. So when you look at a case that was as horrific as Mr. Anwar's death, it's certainly fair to wonder a little bit whether the juvenile system is simply too light to accommodate the crime.
So the sentence is 6 years until she turns 21, but is there anything like a parole in this case? Does she get out early, possibly?
There is a real possibility of that, because in the juvenile system, you have status reports. You know, you check. It's this whole desire for rehabilitation. So there's a lot of monitoring by the court. Even if they're sent away to some sort of residential facility, the court is going to keep hearing from probation about how this person is doing. And so when there's success, when they feel like this person understands the severity of their crime and has turned the corner or gotten away from the elements in the community that were creating some of the problems, there's a tendency to come back to the court and say, hey, let's go ahead and cut this short as a reward mechanism. The other problem, or the other contribution, I suppose, to that notion of cutting the sentence short is the facilities themselves never are in love with the idea of having 20 or 21-year-olds still at their facility as they bring in the new batch of, you know, 14, 15, 16-year-olds. The social dynamic of having 20 or 21-year-olds there at the same facility is not good. So there's a real central pressure on the court to see if the person is doing reasonably well, if they can cut them loose even before turning 21.
A tragic, tragic case. I want to turn to a story out of South Dakota with a number of interesting legal aspects. A member of the state executive branch takes on the federal government. We all recall the 4th of July celebration at Mount Rushmore when President Trump was there and the fireworks. So the governor of South Dakota, Kristi Noem, files a permit to do it again this year. She got turned down. Why'd she get turned down, and then what happened?
Well, this is if you're a law nerd like me, this is a fascinating story. And what happened is the National Park Service rejected her request for a permit to do another follow-up big fireworks show at Mount Rushmore. They cited five different reasons, and we'll get into the vivid details in a second. But some of it had to do with potential wildfires, which has been a recurrent problem out there when there's drought periods. They talked about concerns with crowd control and how it would affect other people vacationing. They talked about ongoing construction on the site. And once again, COVID reared its ugly head, and they said, last time we had this big shindig, there was an awful lot of people that didn't socially distance or wear their masks. So the National Park Service gave five different reasons for rejecting the permit, and Governor Noem decided she wasn't going to just take it, and she went to federal court to sue.
Then what happened?
Well, she lost. That would be the short version. But it's a really interesting kind of case and an interesting, I guess, 36-page opinion. And it talks about a lot of the historical connections there at the land of the Black Hills. I mean, this is overall about 2 million acres of land in South Dakota. It's a huge source of tourism for South Dakota. It's also sacred ground for the Lakota tribe. And so, again, we all probably watched last year and thought it was just, you know, beautiful scenery to see this fireworks event at Mount Rushmore, but that was the first time in a long time. In fact, they hadn't had any fireworks since 2009, and specifically the reason why they were not having fireworks for years and years and years were these little bugs called pine beetles. And pine beetles had decided to maybe imitate the cicadas we're all living with right now by having a population explosion, and they laid waste to the pine trees around Mount Rushmore. So much so that you had all this dead timber piling up and creating a risk of fire. So the Trump fireworks of last year were the first time in many years that they were able to have them. And Governor Noem thought she had a pretty good shot at filing what's called a preliminary injunction or a preliminary mandamus to require the National Park Service to let her do it for a second year.
Okay, from your legal perspective, was that a fair decision by the judge? Who's the good guy? Who's the bad guy here?
Right. Well, I mean, I don't know if there's a good guy because we all kind of lose, right? I think a lot of people would have loved to have at least seen on television a recap of last year's fireworks. But, you know, I guess it's in the eye of the beholder. I mean, this is an Obama appointee judge, so there's going to be some folks that, you know, immediately think this is some sort of petty kind of anti-Trump moment. Although I will say when you read the opinion, the judge sounds very respectful about the motivations for having the fireworks and even kind of compliments the governor about bringing the lawsuit. And frankly, the judge was not totally impressed by several of the grounds cited by the National Park Service as a basis for denial. Now, you could also look at the National Park Service as the bad guy here, or if you really want to add into it, angry tribes. I mean, the Native American tribes that surround the Black Hills view this as a real center of their sacred territory, and they have real problems with the commercialization and the use of it for fireworks. But I think when you really get down to it, the villain in the context of this litigation is a group that kept the fireworks from happening for many years, and those are the pine beetles. I mean, they created a situation where a denial of a permit was really the expectation rather than the exception. So I'd have to save most of my dislike for the pine beetles in this whole thing.
So aside from pinning it on the pine beetles, do you have other broader takeaways?
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, you know, this is really a similar lesson that we had during the election litigation. Remember, all the lawsuits that were filed after the election, you know, most of those challenges were at a different posture than what we think of when we talk about civil suits. They were asking the court to give equitable relief. In other words, some sort of preliminary injunction. And that's where we were with our great pine beetles caper here, that the governor was basically saying, I want you to wade in and force the National Park Service to issue a permit when they said they won't. And so that kind of relief from a court requires a very high standard. And you have to basically convince the judge that there was arbitrary and capricious decision making by the National Park Service and that you're ultimately going to win the lawsuit. And that's very tough to establish. And the pleadings are incredibly important in terms of how you frame them and hope that you can get a judge to agree that even without any evidence that in the long run you're probably going to win. So these are uphill types of lawsuits. There's a lot of deference given to the decision makers that are being challenged. It's a pretty low standard. And I think that's always a decent reminder for people that are thinking about litigation or commenting about civil litigation that, you know, early in a case asking for something extraordinary short of the full-blown merits trial is always uphill.
I tell you, you won't get that kind of coverage of the pine beetle caper on MSNBC or CNN, that's for sure.
This is a hot take, Rick. I mean, we are breaking ground here with these little bugs.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in D.C. You can follow him on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer. Jim, thank you very much.
Sure, thank you.
7 o'clock news is coming up on WMAL. Then back with John Gizzi, Cheryl Atkison, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, and KT McFarland.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. America's reopening. Hear it here. 105.9 FM, WMAL. A Cumulus station.